Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and candidates on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. The next couple shows will be different than most. For the weeks of Christmas and New Year's, we're going to reflect back on this year and look forward to next by playing a highlight reel of sorts, or a quote, best of, Facing the Future from 2018. We've had many fantastic guests and in-depth conversations on key issues, but unfortunately we lack the time to play back all of those great conversations. This week we'll have a few separate segments featuring past legislators who have insight and experience on what fiscal policy was like in the 90s and early 2000s, and perhaps can give us a little context as to what to expect in the future. You'll hear from Governor John Kasich and former Congressman Tim Penny, as well as former Congressman Chris Shays. In the first two segments, you'll hear from Governor Kasich and Congressman Penny from a show that took place in February, one of our first, titled Fiscal Freefall, When Will It Stop? Followed by a conversation with Congressman Shays from back in July titled Elected Leaders, It's Irresponsible to Ignore the Debt. If I've not said it before, I will say it now. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to tune into the show. Your interest in the future of our nation's fiscal policies and support for the program mean a great deal. Keep facing the future. I'm Chase Hageman. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You are about to hear portions of Fiscal Freefall, When Will It Stop? And we are jumping right into the discussion with Bob Bixby, the moderator.
Sitting here with John Kasich and Tim Penny is for me kind of like being, you know, going to a Simon and Garfunkel concert. You know, for people from that were really into budget issues 25 years ago, these were the go-to guys on Capitol Hill, and you had a budget plan that sought to cut the deficit. It was bipartisan. It almost passed. So to get us going, I just thought if you could both reflect a little bit on how did that process get started? How did you hold your group together? And how the heck did you ever get it to the floor for a vote?
Well, let me start, and John can fill in a lot of details. It started with the Clinton budget, you decided needed to be opposed by a Republican alternative. So we had an honest fight over these budget priorities. But for those of us in the Democratic Party, and at that time I was the leader of a group called the Democratic Budget Group, comprised of roughly 60 fiscally conservative Democrats, we weren't delighted with the Clinton budget and asked for the opportunity to offer additional budget cuts later in the budget process. And I will say that the party leadership and the White House at that time were willing to allow that. Partly they needed the several votes that we would bring on board in order to pass their budget, but partly because I don't think they realized they were in for a real fight over additional budget cuts. So we were guaranteed a vote. That's the one thing. And that's what I brought to the table. So I'm trying to figure out how do I make this a serious effort when all I've got is maybe, if I'm lucky, 60 Democrats that will vote for this. And I'm starting to talk to a handful of Republicans. And in the well of the House, John Kasich comes running over and he says, Penny, you're going to need my help. And I thought, well, he's the ranking Republican on the Budget Committee. I'm not stupid. Yeah, I could use his help. So we put together a process in which I had a group probably numbering 30 Democrats that were willing to work on this. He had a group of roughly 30 Republicans, and he made sure some of the key Republicans were in that group. We then formed subgroups addressing every piece of the budget, domestic and defense, and had equal numbers from both parties on each subgroup, and said that they had to scour their budget for savings, their part of the budget for savings, and that it was going to be decided. Recommendations were to come from these subgroups only if a majority of the Democrats and a majority of the Republicans on each of these task forces agreed. But then once all of those recommendations came forward, it was all for one and one for all, that even though there were going to be tough things to swallow in this plan for all of us, we were going to bring it forward and we were going to stay glued. And so we did. And I think that process of building this budget reduction effort in that fashion had an integrity to it that isn't often seen on Capitol Hill. And I think that's why we came within four votes of actually passing that, despite, and John may describe this, despite opposition from almost every quarter here in the nation's capital.
You know, it's kind of revive. I've always believed that if you can get people in a room and you can talk to them honestly and get them to search themselves, good things will come out of them. So when we formed this group, we had confidence that people would make intellectually honest decisions, and they did. That always really meant a lot to me. But I always believed that. I always thought that, even when I was a kid, that you can get people together. So even in my state, you know, I've done something on police and community. We did move mountains on that by having people of different philosophies work on that. I'm doing it now on guns. You know, you don't get everything you want, but, you know, hopefully you can get people together and they can think, because people are, by nature, if you call them out, just like I say, it's written on our hearts, you can get people, if they feel that process is fair, to do extraordinary things. So who fought us? Well, all the Appropriations Committee, Hillary was up there, Clinton was there, they were all of them. It was a bipartisan opposition, and then all the special interest groups. So it was pretty amazing we came so close. I mean, we got really, really close to winning. And it was the first shot fired in the effort to balance the budget. So we did balance the budget. We did pay down the largest amount of the publicly held debt in 97. We had surpluses, and, you know, just like Simon and Garfunkel, you know, there was a bridge over troubled waters. The bridge collapsed, and we're all drowning in red ink now. So it's pretty bad. And, you know, the biggest problem with all the spending is it's all theoretical and hypothetical. Nobody cares. I mean, I said to my folks, I said, you know, how are we going to describe this? I think they put something. We're $20 trillion in the hole. Okay, well, why not $20 billion? I mean, nobody cares. Nobody understands it. But at some point, this will have a dramatic impact on our economic growth, which will, in fact, divide this country even more than it's currently divided. And they're all in on the game, all of them. They spend money like there's no tomorrow. It's a sad, sad situation. Now, could you get people together with the proper leaders to get them to start saying we need to do some things? Yes. The other point I'd like to make is, I don't believe that creating savings on operation of our government means we got to go out somehow and hammer somebody. You know, got to go and cut. All right. Well, reform is where we are. You might remember years ago when we all went out and bought these, what were they called? Not iPads, but they were the thing you read on, a Kindle. Okay. Now they'll pay you to buy it. They'll give you a Kindle and give you money. In other words, things are changing so fast that there are ways in which you can make enormous savings without having to hurt anything. That's the beauty of technology. Better ways to do things. And it just takes the will to do it. And I don't know whether they're ever going to have it. I know my kids are going to be paying for the sins of our generation. But when we look at kids today, We're seeing a new level of activism. I am so excited about what I'm seeing in this country with these young people. They, thank God. We either taught them or they learned from us and all the stupid things we did so they could figure it out and do better.
Well, that's where I was going to go next with this, because we fast forward 25 years. We're about to start a new budget process. Seems like things, you know, certainly the debt is twice as high as it was then as a percentage of GDP. And we boomers are now retiring. We're very much part of the problem and was sort of gotten off of the hook, I guess. But we look back and it's really, I mean, answering the question of, you know, why does the deficit matter and why is it a really important thing for future generations? I mean, I think that the most important thing about this is you know, investing in our nation and the generational aspects of it. But, you know, is this what really has driven both of you to be such passionate advocates for fiscal discipline?
Well, look, for me in my state, if we can't balance a budget, we're not going to get any jobs. And if we don't have any jobs, we take away people's dignity because people want to work. I mean, that's a part of human dignity. The human condition is being productive. And so I know that in my state, if I've got a budget where they don't know what the heck's going to happen tomorrow, and look at Illinois. I mean, a place is a disaster. You know, land of Lincoln, people don't want to, are we going to go open a business in Illinois? Yeah, great. So I knew that in my state, it's directly connected. I also used to have this debt clock. Tim, you see this debt clock. When I was out running for president, maybe you didn't know that. I didn't win, but I did run. And so when I would have the clock, and there were a lot of young people would come to my stuff, and I would say, when that debt goes up, your job opportunities go down, and when the debt goes down, your job opportunities go up.
Interesting remarks from Governor Kasich on the importance of sound budgeting practices and younger generations getting civically engaged. You have been listening to a special segment of Facing the Future as we tune into portions of Fiscal Freefall, When Will It Stop? I'm your host, Chase Hageman. We will be back after these short messages with more from Republican Ohio Governor John Kasich, former Democratic Congressman Tim Penny, and Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. We are continuing with Fiscal Freefall, When Will It Stop? A panel discussion with Republican Ohio Governor John Kasich and former Democratic Congressman Tim Penny, moderated by Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby. When we left the conversation, Governor Kasich was discussing the importance of millennial involvement in the political process. Now we will jump right into Congressman Penny discussing needed reforms in some of the major spending programs in the budget, like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid.
A friend of ours, Gene Sterley, wrote a book recently. I think the title was Dead Men Ruling. And basically what the book elaborates on is that politicians of the past created our entitlement structure, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and that increasingly those programs are consuming a larger and larger share of the total budget. Which then inevitably crowds out everything else. Just last year alone, because of the general fund obligations that have to go to the Medicare program, we were spending about $300 billion of general fund money to support the Medicare program. It's not paid for by premiums or by Medicare taxes. It's paid for increasingly by the general fund. That means that half of our roughly $600 billion deficit was just that program alone. And it only gets worse as time goes by because 10,000 baby boomers are retiring every single day. So again, getting back to the premise of Gene Sterley's book, it's that pretty soon we're going to be doing nothing with today's dollars because we won't have today's dollars. We're only going to be paying for programs that were designed and enacted by politicians who are now dead. And that seems to me to be intergenerational theft. And so to me, this ought to be an issue that helps to motivate young people to take an interest in this.
But the wonderful thing here is that there are ways to fix these programs that are really pretty simple, just a little. Now, not Social Security. That one, we put that off for so long, it's just terrible what's going to have to happen. Because the longer you wait, it's no different than your teeth, you know. If you don't go to the dentist, by the time you do go, you either have to have a root canal or they yank it out. I mean, that's the problem with Social Security now. The numbers are just not working. But with Medicaid, we think we can save lots of money without having to affect anybody. And the same is true with Medicare. And how about this? How about having a healthcare system that's based on quality, not based on quantity? How about if you actually went to the doctor and they treated you for what you had, not 18 billion tests, so because there's no exactness to it? And these things can be fixed. How about some managed care, some coordinated care for people on Medicaid and Medicare? These are things that can go a long way, and it doesn't mean you got to hurt anybody in the process.
Well, getting back to Social Security, John, you don't know how lucky you were that Bush did not appoint you to that Social Security Commission, because like so many other bipartisan commissions, a good report just went on a shelf and has collected dust now for 15 years. And you're right about the dilemma that creates for us, because the baby boomers are now retiring. Now, we've long since passed the day that annual Social Security payroll taxes paid for our Social Security program. We're now eating into the trust fund. And the trust fund is a fiction. It's an IOU that the rest of the budget owes back to the Social Security system, because we spent the Social Security surplus, which we tried to build up with those reforms that we voted for back in 1983. You're right. You know, every day that we waste, and we wasted 15 years since the last major attempt to reform this program, the problem just gets worse, and therefore it gets that much harder to fix.
I think the magnitude, you were mentioning this before, Tim, is that Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security are almost 50%, about 50% of the non-interest part of the federal budget now, and there'll be about 60% within 10 years. So if you're a millennial, that can be somewhat concerning. The other thing that it has the effect of, and I'd like to get your impression on this too, is squeezing other programs, the so-called discretionary programs, which are 30% and going to be shrinking to about a quarter of the federal budget. What is the opportunity cost there, both in terms of national security and things that the federal government could do in investment, whether it's workforce training or productivity-enhancing investments that that we can't do because so much of the budget is devoted to interest and entitlements?
Yeah, well, the problem with interest and entitlements is that it's money spent on nothing new. It buys us nothing new. It's current consumption. To the degree that there's any investment in our federal budget, and I always am leery of the term investment, because anytime you want to argue for more government spending, you somehow claim it's an investment. But there is some investment there, and to the degree that there is investment in the federal budget, it's in the discretionary items, and that does get crowded. Of course, here's the other, the reality in D.C. is that while we all yearn for bipartisan cooperation, especially on the big issues that need to be resolved, once in a while, when Congress does act in a bipartisan fashion, it's only to make matters worse. And
you have anything in mind?
and there was some budget deal just a couple weeks ago where the solution to both sides' intransigence was for each side to get more of what it wanted, and so they restored discretionary spending, but they did it all with borrowed money. So now over the next 2 years, we basically said we're going to come to a budget agreement that increases the deficit and adds to the debt to the tune of about $340 billion. I don't know what's going to happen with this tax cut. There's another deficit-financed policy. When we reformed tax policy back in 1986, it was deficit neutral. We lowered rates, but we cleaned up the code. And we did not add to the deficit, but by cleaning up the code, we incented economic growth. That's the right kind of tax reform. So maybe there'll be economic growth as a result of this, but the Joint Committee on Taxation said maybe a third of the lost revenue gets recovered with economic growth. So we're kind of pushing ourselves, or I shouldn't say we're pushing, we're crawling ever closer to that cliff because of more recent policies. And John talks about in his opening sermon about doing the right thing, and as you look back on your life, those things that maybe weren't so easy tend to be the things I'm inferring your remarks that you're the most proud of. We need more truth tellers about paying for what we say we want, and I think there's an audience for that. And this may be where the millennials can be our hope, because I think they, more so than the current generation of voters, would resonate with this message that there is, you can't have something for nothing, that you do have to pay for what we want as a society, and with the right messenger and the right way of crafting the message, I think that there might be some hope that we can find leaders that will step forward and resonate with this new generation, because we've gotten us, we, the baby boomers and others, have gotten us to this point. And I don't think we any longer are the solution. I think we have to rely on this next generation to be the solution.
So I go up to New Hampshire, and I go visit this. I'm in a running for president, right? I did pretty well up there. Anyway, so I go to this military base. Do you live in New Hampshire?
I do not, but our New Hampshire state director is here.
Okay, yeah. You remember Tyler, when I went up to that base and I started talking about how much infrastructure you know how many bases and forts and structures we have in this country that we don't need? Will, how many do we have that we don't need? Tell them. Many, right? Okay, but we won't close any of them down, because it's pork barrel politics. So we got to bump the defense budget up by $700 billion because we don't have the guts to say, you don't need this anymore. Now, here's what's interesting. When you shut these old places down, it leads to economic development. It's some of the most prime land. You can turn lemons into lemonade. But boy, that's not easy up front. Because if I have to go get that flu shot, when they put that needle in my arm, I won't like it. Leadership, folks, is what it's all about.
Actually, Pease Air Force Base, they did that. It's a really growing area. They closed it down many years ago in one of the base closing commissions, and it's one of the most booming.
And this just reminded me of something I left off my list. He was one of the chief architects of the base closure commission back in the late 80s.
Speaking of...
Then it died, by the way. We have not had one since.
Well, it lasted for a while.
This recording, we actually have a radio program on WKXL News Radio Concord, New Hampshire, called Facing the Future, and all of our remarks today are going to be next week's show.
Oh wow! So we have to run to the end of the time period.
Well, I'm supposed
period.
To go up there for a town hall. I guess maybe I'll reconsider.
So I guess
see if I can.
I wanted to say, as our closing remarks here, there's some articles. I've got a friend that's thinking of running for president, you know, and I just wanted to give some advice to this friend, you know. What would you, if you knew somebody that was thinking about running for president and was talking to a New Hampshire radio audience, what kind of an agenda would you, what kind of advice would you give them for an agenda?
Which is it, advice or an agenda? I'll give you advice.
Whichever you prefer.
I'll give you the best advice. Be real. End of story. Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool. They smell a fraud. You don't suck up. You go up. You do your thing. It's a great... Now, I'll say one thing about New Hampshire. Here's the cool thing about it. New Hampshire is a place, it is a postage stamp, a cross-section of America. Rural, urban... lots of independence, young, old. It's an incredible place. And the beautiful thing about that is it does represent a snapshot of our country. And it's a great process up there. I mean, there's so many things that ought to be changed. But you know what the key is? Be who you are. Have fun. I told Hickenlooper that. I said, why don't you run? You're not going to lose anything if you don't win. Go out and have some fun. And by the way, I like New Hampshire a lot. Okay.
Hey, that seems like a pretty good place to end it. Thanks for giving us your inspiration. Thanks for your 25 years since the Penny Kasich and still being involved in that. And see you in New Hampshire.
Sound advice from Governor Kasich. In New Hampshire, we make candidates work for whatever elected office they are pursuing. You have been listening to a special segment of Facing the Future as we tuned into portions of Fiscal Freefall, When Will It Stop?, a panel discussion between Republican Ohio Governor John Kasich and former Democratic Congressman Tim Penny, moderated by Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I am your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by former Congressman Chris Shays. Congressman Shays served in the U.S. House for over 20 years, representing the 4th District of Connecticut as a Republican. He served on the Government Reform, Financial Services, Budget, and Homeland Security Committees, and I'm privileged to have him on Facing the Future this week. Thanks for joining the show, Congressman.
Thank you, Chase. Happy to be with you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on the show, and the reason why I wanted to have you on this week is we are amidst a midterm election nationwide, and it's in full steam here in New Hampshire. In fact, starting next week, we'll have some candidates that are running for Congress here on the show. So I wanted to get some insight from you. You've served quite a long time, especially in Congress from 1987 to 2009, and some time in the Connecticut State House before that. So what was it like for you to run for public office both at the state level and then at the congressional level?
Well, it's a lot different running now than it was when I ran, particularly the State House and even in Congress. In the State House, you know, I only had to raise $15,000. And it was more personal because it was just pretty much your neighborhood. When you ran for Congress, the district was bigger. We had to raise a noticeable amount of money. But my last two elections, I think we raised $4 million each time. And I felt it was, frankly, obscene. I come from a wealthy district, so it was easier for me to raise money than most. But frankly, most members spend a lot of time in Washington. Instead of being in public hearings, they spend their time raising money. So, and I'll just make one last point. Controversy is the enemy of the incumbent. And there's so much controversy right now. And you have a president, candidly, I might add, who is everything my parents taught me not to be and everything we taught our daughter not to be. So, and his approach is to divide, not to unite. And you're either with him or against him. So, and he is purposely doing that because he believes, and I think people don't really understand this about him, he believes with a small, dedicated minority, he can win elections. And if he doesn't let people kind of be centrist and logical and support things that they like that he may not like, if he doesn't allow that, you're just stuck with him.
And Congressman, you raised some great points along the way there, especially about what it's like to have to campaign in current day, raising as much money as candidates have to, and also having a really divided partisan environment. I'm curious. You alluded to it changing, over your time in Congress, and I wonder if you could attribute some reasons for why we are where we are right now.
Well, when I was first elected to Congress, we were the Republicans in the minority, and you had Bob Michael, our minority leader, frankly, somewhat content to be in the minority because they gave him the best office, and he was still meeting with the president, and he was being given certain things from the Democrats. I mean, the leadership had a role to play, even in the minority. When Newt Gingrich came in, he said, I don't want to be in the minority anymore. And he blew the place up. And But in addition, we got elected in 94 with a program. We called it the Contract with America. But every item on it, the 10 things we do on opening day and the 10 things we do in the first 100 days, had 70% support of the American people, every one of those items. What happened, though, was Republicans were learning how to be in the majority. Democrats were learning how to be in the minority, and they didn't like it. And so what you started to see was Republicans went after the blue dog Democrats, the centrists in the Democratic Party, and Democrats went after the moderate Republicans, the centrists in the Republican Party. And so you have kind of a carved-out middle where you have people, Democrats on the extreme left and Republicans on the extreme right, and they don't talk to each other.
And I take it it was, just by what you said there, it was easier to be bipartisan, say, in the late 80s, early 90s, as opposed to in this century.
Well, yeah, but for reasons that Republicans were just kind of used to being in the minority, and Democrats were used to being in the majority. Now that it's so competitive, neither party wants to tolerate anybody in the middle because they want to win that election. In other words, the Democrats targeted me. In fact, just to give you an example, I was working with Democrats and Republicans on so many issues. And one day I'm about to go into the chamber and I get a Democratic member who I had worked on a number of bills with and got signed into law. And she said, "Chris, don't sit next to me. I'm not allowed to work with you."
Wow.
And, you know, what bugged me was a few days later, I was watching Nancy Pelosi, who was now the minority, the speaker. And she said to the press, "Why can't we all get along?" Well, we all can't get along is because she didn't want us to get along, and yet she was asking that question. So when I was elected, Republicans and Democrats at 4 in the afternoon, some of us would go down to the house gyms, a modest gym, but we had great fun playing basketball with each other and getting some exercise and forgetting, you know, some of the pressures of our job. And, you know, so Democrats and Republicans played on the same side, and we had great games. If you go down there now, nobody plays basketball. In fact, if Republicans and Democrats are interacting with each other, they take great pride in, say, driving in the same car together. But they're not working with each other. They're not putting their country first. They're putting their party first.
And we've had other former members of Congress on the show, and they talked about that very thing, how members of Congress used to go to the gym together, ride in cars together, eat together, and now that doesn't really happen anymore. So from your perspective, how do you think we get back to that point, or even, you know, can we get back to that point as a nation and as a Congress?
Well, we have to get back to that point because we're not getting anything done. You know, it's the whole concept. Let me just put it differently. Most Americans are in the middle of the political spectrum. They're probably more conservative than they are liberal. So it's right of center. But most members of Congress are either to the left or right. So Congress isn't representing the American people right now. They're representing their partisan districts, but they're not representing the American people. And no good comes from that. When you put your party first, you're not looking out for America.
And you may have just answered what my next question was going to be, so maybe you can elaborate on it. But what recommendations or suggestions would you make to current candidates in this climate on either side of the aisle?
Well, be willing to lose an election. And sometimes if you're willing to lose an election, you can win it. Go in with a platform of things you want to do for your constituency. When I was going door to door as a state rep, if my opponent had a sign on the lawn of that house, I went into that house and I knocked on the door and I said, "I know you're voting for my opponent in the race," or I might have mentioned their name, but I'd say, "But if I'm elected, this is how you get in touch with me." And I wasn't there just to get votes. I was there to listen to them and to get a sense of where they're from. So candidates need to listen. They need to learn. They need to help. And they need to lead. And that's their job. And they need to put their country first. And otherwise, don't bother running, because otherwise you're just in it for yourself. And in the end, it won't be very satisfying. I can tell you this. Very few members in Congress feel like they're doing the Lord's work right now. They don't feel like they're part of a process that is working. And I will tell you, if we don't resolve this, the American people are going to rebel. So what I'm hoping happens is that we have a third person running in the presidential election, because we did not have two good candidates on either side of the political equation.
And yeah, actually, that reminds me. I believe you were a supporter of Governor John Kasich for most of the 2016 primary election. He spoke a lot, I think, about fiscal and budget policy. And I was curious, you know, we talk a lot about fiscal policy on this show. We're facing some growing national budget deficits, a growing national debt. You know, how serious of an issue should that be for candidates right now?
Well, we beat the USSR, not militarily, we beat them economically. They just collapsed economically. And the foolishness that's going on now is people don't realize it's an economic war in this day and age. It's not a military war. And we are putting ourselves in such jeopardy. You know, the French Revolution began, I've been having fun studying it. It was a 10-year process, but it began because France got broke. The 7 years war with Great Britain, and then they supported us against Great Britain in our Revolutionary War, and they literally went bankrupt. They borrowed money, and more than half their budget was paying debt. And we're getting to the point where too much of our expenses is just carrying the debt costs, and it would get larger as the interest rates go up. So it's totally irresponsible that no one is focused on the debt, because it is our biggest problem.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking with former Congressman Chris Shays. We're discussing what candidates for Congress in New Hampshire might be facing in this upcoming election. And I want to switch gears here, Congressman, to talk a little bit more about your experience, specifically with the budget process. Looking at last year's budget process and this year's budget process, it seems to be sort of limping along, sometimes completely broken. What was it like when you were in Congress to be a part of the appropriations process, coming up with budget resolutions, that sort of thing?
Well, first off, it was a blast being on the Budget Committee with John Kasich, because he was outspoken about the need to get our country's financial house in order. And we were aided, and I had made reference to a third party person in the presidential debate. Ross Perot ran on a simple platform. He said, we're raising so much money each year, we're spending more than we raise. The gap between what we spend and what we raise is a deficit. Every year the deficit is added to the debt, and every year the debt grows. And he said it in such a simple way, and after he lost, he got about 20% of the vote, I think, close to it. But after he lost, both parties were faced with a constituency that wanted us to deal with the deficit. And when we, the Republicans, won in 94, We had a very aggressive plan. It was part of our contract with America. We balanced the budget. 4 years we had surpluses, actual surpluses. And we were making the country stronger. And then in 2000, the tools we used, Grand Mudman and other tools that we had, had expired. And the Budget Committee lost its clout with the Budget Committee. The Budget Committee lost its clout with the appropriators to spend the money in the ways and means people who tax.
And Congressman, you mentioned budgetary tools and laws such as the Graham-Rudman Act. You also had the Budget Enforcement Act of 1990, where you had, you know, threats of things like sequester, and then we had PAYGO for a while. Are tools like that necessary to get Congress to stay within the boundaries of the budget process, or is it really more a failing of leadership?
Well, it's both. A leadership could do it without the tools. The tools make it a lot easier, though, to get it done, as long as leadership is supportive. After John Kasich left and we started to go back into deficit, I was made the vice chairman of the Budget Committee, and I attached on all those tools that we had to the budget, which were no longer part of the budget. And I attached it when it reached out, and I held up the Budget Committee with the support of other budget group members for a week. When it got to the floor, our leadership took out, through the Rules Committee, took out all those tools. So I said I'd vote against my own budget. And they did a promise with me that we would have a separate vote on the tools. Well, when the Graham-Rudman and sequestration was voted on as a separate item, the Democrats voted against it, and the appropriators and some of the longtime members of the Republican Party voted against it, and it didn't pass. And I might add that the next time around, I was replaced as the vice chairman of the budget committee.
Mm.
It's really sad. Part of the problem is that we tell people that deficits are bad, but nobody sees that anything bad happening. So you kind of, you know, lose your credibility and your impact with the general public. What will happen, though, is interest rates sometime in the not too distant future will rise, and that means we'll have to pay more just to cover the debt we already have, and that will squeeze out so many things that we need to do, and then the public's going to be angry, and then they're going to be concerned, and I can tell you, members of Congress are going to be put in a desperate situation. The bottom line is I just want to make this point: the cure almost will kill the patient.
And that's the difficult part about this, I think. We've gotten in such a habit as a nation and in a Congress of responding to crises and acting only in those desperate times and not looking at the long-term reforms. At least that's my perspective. You may disagree in some aspects.
No, you're dead right. You're dead right. No, we're only dealing with it when it's a crisis. In fact, even when a crisis, we're not dealing with it. In the French Revolution, the king was, his finance minister was borrowing money that the government had to pay back, and they were just lying to their prospective borrower, the people they were borrowing money from, and then it just collapsed. And we're going to see really what almost will amount to a collapse.
To avoid a collapse, to try and avoid that crisis, what reforms do you think are necessary right now? How do you spur Congress on to act now as opposed to later?
First off, every member of Congress should be forced to deal with this problem and say what their solution is. And then when you talk about the solutions, they're difficult and they're not so difficult. We need to slow the growth of entitlements, not freeze them. And we need to freeze the non-entitlement government expenditures. And we have to do some consolidating. I mean, it's a political issue, but the Department of Education and the Labor Department should be one. They should be focused on the future prosperity of young people who need to get work. And that's education for, you know, the technology that we're being faced with today. The Defense Department has too many bases, and we're going to have to close some. And the irony is that, you know, the president can go around and complain about the cost of our troops overseas. In some cases, it's cheaper to have our troops overseas than it is in the United States. Here they're increasing the defense budget and then complaining that others aren't doing their fair share, but we're still increasing the defense budget, and we need to put those troops somewhere. We're not going to keep all our troops in the United States. So, and we don't get charged for the bases that we have overseas. So there's just not much honest dialogue going on. The truth is helpful.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Congressman Chris Shays discuss the current congressional races in New Hampshire, what candidates are facing, as well as what's going on in the budget process, and as the congressman aptly put, the need for honest dialogue on these issues. Congressman, thanks so much for joining the show today.
Hey, enjoyed being with you.